I'm Dr. Michio Kaku, host of the science program Exploration. In this hour, we're talking about the very real threat of an expanding nuclear industry. We all know how dangerous nuclear weapons are, but the push for nuclear power plants is just as much a threat to the world. On October 22, 2007, Jackson Brown, Graham Nash, and Bonnie Raitt delivered petitions to our United States Congress begging them to halt nuclear power plants and proliferation. They are the founders of the Musicians for a Safe Energy group that organized the No Nukes concerts, and in fact, I spoke with them earlier about this.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war.
Well, first let me say I've been a great fan of you four individuals. You've been pioneers, opening up whole new realms for social protest and social change. But here's a question I've always wanted to ask you. And that is, why did you guys initially take such brave and courageous positions on something so controversial as nuclear energy, even though there was, of course, a certain personal risk that you may alienate some fans? And Graham, was there any incident in your past that sparked your interest about nuclear energy and got you motivated to speak out publicly against nuclear energy?
There was one particular incident. I was lucky enough to be having dinner with Jacques Cousteau. And over the course of dinner, I asked him what his biggest fear for humanity was. And quite frankly, I expected a sea answer, an ocean answer, a whale's dolphin kind of answer. Instead, Jacques looked at me and he said, "Nuclear police." And I said, "Pardon?" He said, "Nuclear police. There is going to be a time when people will be able to come to your door without any warrants and harass you about whether you had fissionable material in your house. There was going to be a time when people would be able to come to your door as nuclear police to try and figure out what's going on." And I was shocked at the answer, frankly. And he began to tell me about what he referred to as the snake of the nuclear industry, with miners dying from cancer from uranium poisoning at one end, and the terrorist activity and the problems with storing nuclear waste at the other end of the snake. And it was shocking to me that Jacques Cousteau would say this, and I obviously respected him a great deal and wanted to investigate further what he was saying. And the more I investigated, the more scared I became, and the more determined that I would, if given the opportunity, act. And we did.
And Bonnie, was there a particular incident that got you motivated to take a position on nuclear energy?
Yes, I would say that, first of all, having been raised a Quaker, my family was very involved in the nuclear arms race and banning the bomb movement. And so I was aware from a young child of the dangers of fallout and the Hiroshima Maidens had come to visit our Quaker meeting when I was a child, and it very greatly affected me, the whole specter of looking to nuclear anything, either proliferation or the danger of that substance being unleashed. We did not have the emotional and societal maturity to be able to handle what our brilliant minds had come up with. And so around the time of the proposition in California and us gathering together to stop oil drilling and save the redwoods and different environmental issues and promote solar, right around that time the Karen Silkwood case went down, and the family approached me in about, I think it was 1978, to see if I would do, with some friends of mine, put together a benefit concert to raise money for the Karen Silkwood Defense Fund against the Kerr-McGee nuclear plant. And that's basically when my fundraising involvement started. And soon after, Three Mile Island, the success of the China Syndrome, the various news stories talking about the accidents at different plants around the world, it was really became front burner for me the more I educated myself, and when I realized the sinister nature of the industry, and I don't mean to speak in conspiratorial terms, I just mean the whole Silkwood case was really a horrifying awakening on my political consciousness about how serious this issue was in terms of what their agenda was. And at the same time, the great boom in solar, so Solar Cal was a program we tried to get started in California, and we lobbied for that with Tom Hayden. And back in the 70s, there was really a push towards moving towards renewables, which at the time people thought were not cost-effective. So we were always involved with stopping nuclear power because of the dangers of it and because of the problems of waste and storage and cost overruns and terrorist targets and all the rest. But also at the same time, we were very excited about the idea of promoting green alternative technologies. And that's something that 30 years on, what has changed is that now it's a $15 billion a year industry, wind. And people are, as Harvey has told us, lining up to invest in these renewables.
And Bonnie, for those people who don't know the Karen Silkwood case, even though there was a movie with Cher about it, could you just simply briefly summarize for our listeners what the Karen Silkwood case was and why it galvanized so many people?
Well, Karen Silkwood worked in a nuclear power plant, and she was very much aware of cost-cutting or fudging facts of safety violations. And she, in fact, was mounting evidence and arranging to meet with a New York Times reporter when her car was mysteriously run off the road, and at the time when she was going to present the evidence. And in the ensuing months, a lot of the people that were also going to be testifying at the trial mysteriously disappeared. So it was a horrifying circumstance that really brought the level of what goes on in the shadow worlds of politics. That really brought was a rude awakening for me, and I think the movie was an incredible success because people, the bloom was off the rose. I mean, between that and the China Syndrome and the actual horrifying accidents at Three Mile Island, that really brought to the American public, I think, the whole issue of the danger of nuclear power. And, you know, I would urge people, if they want to read about it, they could probably Google her. That's the great thing about the Internet is you get instant history and rent a movie and see it. It's an education that needs to be learned about how things work.
Jackson, was there anything in your early history that got you really fired up about nuclear energy?
Well, at the time I became aware of the problem, it wasn't so much a controversy. It was kind of unknown. It was the kind of thing, something I hadn't really heard about before, but it was an emergency at that point because of the danger to the populace, you know, from radiation. There was a movement mounting, but I mean, by the time you hear about this, you focus on the danger to the population at large and the risk to future generations and especially the political risk of allowing them to proliferate at a rate that will be impossible to deal with the consequences. It was an emergency then, and it's an emergency now. In the ensuing 30 years, I have to say, it hasn't been much of an emergency because we really thought that the issue had been sort of settled then, you know, in the 70s when it became apparent that it was when it was apparent to the industry that they couldn't get the popular support in the communities, and when it was also and no new plants were ordered, you know, until now. Of course, with global warming, the nuclear industry has taken the position that now it's appropriate technology and now we need it and we have to ignore all the dangers and just move forward, even though they haven't solved any of the problems disposing of the waste. And so, once again, what we did just recently was to try to, you know, sound the alarm and let people know that they were about to sneak legislation into the clean energy bill that allowed them to, you know, proliferate, you know, wildly with 120 new plants over the next few years and asking the public to pay for this, you know, to the tune of, you know, $50 billion in the next 2 years. So, you know, it was an emergency then and an emergency now. I don't think the question of it's being controversial. I mean, it's controversial. I'd say it's more controversial now than it was then.
Yes.
And Harvey, you've been there since the very beginning of the anti-nuclear movement, present at the creation, as they say. What motivated you?
Yeah, it was kind of blind luck, although I got to say I was there even before the beginning because I was very pro-nuclear until the 1970s. I had done a report on nuclear power in ninth grade, which at the time kind of qualified me as an expert. And back then, everybody was in favor of nuclear power. And ironically, if you go back and you look at the Port Huron Statement of 1960, the founding document of Students for Democratic Society, the, you know, the leftist organization on campuses in the 60s, there was a line in favor of nuclear power. And most of us thought it was going to be a, you know, kind of a magic bullet. But I guess the term bullet turned out to be a little more prophetic, because in 1973, I was living on an organic farm in western Massachusetts, and the local utility company, we were a bit older than out of college, and the local utility company came in and said they wanted to build a nuclear plant 4 miles from our house. And we very quickly surmised that we would not be able to do organic farming with a nuclear power plant nearby. And there was a very important book that we all read called Poisoned Power by Dr. John Goffman, who lived out his days in San Francisco and just recently passed away. Dr. Goffman was the chief medical researcher for the Atomic Energy Commission. And like so many other people, he was a major proponent of nuclear power. And yet the commission had asked him to do a definitive study on the health impacts of radiation, assuming that there wouldn't be any. And Dr. Goffman, who is a world-renowned medical researcher, in fact, many of his findings on LDL cholesterol are still very much with us, and also a participant in the Manhattan Project. I mean, he had incredible credentials as both a nuclear chemist and a medical doctor. He surmised in 1969 that normal, so-called normal radiation releases from nuclear power plants would kill 32,000 Americans a year. And this was, you know, when the plants were smaller and there were far fewer of them. And, of course, the AEC was not happy with these findings, and they forced him out. But he wrote a book called Poisoned Power with Arthur Tamplin, which was published by the Rodale Press, who were the same people that published our organic gardening handbook. And so when we read this book and put two and two together, we decided that nuclear power was not for us and not for the planet. And it seemed like a NIMBY thing at first, but in fact, we quickly realized that this was a global issue. And we coined the phrase no nukes at our farm in Montague. And I guess we were somewhat present at the creation, although there had been some successful anti-reactor campaigns in the 60s, notably in the New York area, which forced Indian Point to be removed from an island across from Manhattan. But, nothing since 1973 has changed our mind. As Bonnie mentioned, you know, there is now a booming renewable energy industry. There is, of course, as Jackson mentioned, no solution to the nuclear waste problem. And what we have discovered, unfortunately, is that all the premonitions that Dr. Goffman had about the killing power of radiation are very true. And I will have to say that, you know, many of us have turning point experiences. And mine came 7 years after we stopped the nuclear, well, after we began fighting in Montague and we subsequently stopped that plant. I went in as a reporter into central Pennsylvania, you know, kind of like my a lunch with Jacques Cousteau. I wasn't sure what I was going to find. And I spent the worst week of my life in central Pennsylvania in 1980, a year after the accident, interviewing people who had been harmed, actually harmed by the radiation. And you know, I went from house to house to house, and it was absolutely terrifying. I could say what I mean. To scream, I should quiet it down. I could be recognized, or I could stand there, look the world in the eye.
And you've been listening to an interview with three rock giants: Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, and Bonnie Raitt, founders of the Musicians United for Safe Energy about 30 years ago. And on October 22, 2007, they presented a petition to the United States Congress asking Congress to halt nuclear power plants and nuclear proliferation. And now let's get back to our interview with three rock giants: Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, Bonnie Raitt, and anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman, as we talk about global warming and nuclear energy. Will nuclear energy save us from global warming, or will it simply add to the problem?
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow.
Okay, now let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the present situation where people are concerned about global warming. The United Nations has come out with very dire predictions about what's going to happen if cities go underwater and droughts and floods afflict many nations of the world. However, there are some environmentalists who are saying that, well, maybe nuclear is the way to go. It doesn't create carbon dioxide. It doesn't accentuate global warming. Maybe nuclear power is the white knight. And Graham, what do you tell well-meaning environmentalists, people with good intentions who are reaching for nuclear as a possible option? Is that jumping out of the frying pan into the fire?
Here's what's going on. Nuclear power will not help with global warming. First of all, it will take, you know, at least 10 years to get any new nuclear power plant online. Conversely, it would take a couple of years to get several wind farms online. And if you blow up a wind farm, you know, so the towers fall over. But if you blow up a nuclear power plant, which I believe was the intent of the first plane that hit the World Trade Center, was originally targeted for Indian Point and, in fact, flew over Indian Point. The terrorists thought that it would be too well guarded, and so they changed their target to the World Trade Center. To supply the power to run a nuclear power plant takes, you know, in most estimates, you know, a couple of coal fire plants to provide the energy to run the nuclear power. Yes, it does not give CO2, but it puts a tremendous amount of heat into the atmosphere. There are rivers in France that are 90 degrees Fahrenheit right now, killing everything in the river. It's a guise. They're gonna pull the wool over your eyes by saying that nuclear power is gonna be able to save global warming, and it's a fallacy. And if you check the facts, you'll realize that it's a fallacy. And it's a mechanism by which the industry will be able to revive itself and make millions and millions of dollars. And it won't cost them a penny. It will cost the American people billions and billions of dollars if we let this sentence in the energy bill stay in the energy bill.
You are listening to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive's weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio.
We were reading information, trying to get as much information as possible, and as usual with songwriters and poets, it comes out somewhere. This came out this way. It's called A Barrel of Pain, and it's basically about the barrels of nuclear waste that are lying on the bottom of the ocean just outside of San Francisco, which is where I live. I can see the writing on the wall. I can hear the axe before it falls. I can really feel it getting through to me. I can see the sea begin to glow. I can feel it leaking down below. I can barely stand it, what you're doing to me. And in the morning, will you still feel the same? How are you gonna stop yourself from going insane? With glowing children and a barrel of pain, I don't wanna hear it no more, no more.
That was Graham Nash from Survival Sunday 2 on June 26, 1979.
And Bonnie, what motivated you with your colleagues to go to the Congress on October 22nd and present a petition, against commercial nuclear energy, even though people are concerned about global warming?
I think, thank goodness for the internet, and thank goodness for the anti-nuke safe energy grassroots organizations that keep us informed. And Harvey happened to pick up a sentence in a New York Times article, August 31st, that mentioned this amendment that was being tucked in by Senator Domenici. Basically, without the without any public awareness and without any debate, there was some debate, but the language was deliberately vague and inserted into this otherwise great energy bill. And unbeknownst to most of the people in Congress, and certainly to a lot of us, we wanted to be able to bring this out into the open and see if we could get it stopped or get the amendment discussed and have some sort of forum on it. And, of course, from our point of view, any kind of low guarantees for a private industry that hasn't been able to support itself, we wanted that language out. So we rallied immediately and decided to put together a petition and to utilize the incredible organizing power of the Internet to get this information out to the public through a YouTube video. We decided to record a song, and everyone scrambled to get background information on a website that was beautifully designed in a short period of time, and Harvey did all the writing for it, and it was a team effort, and we came together within 2 or 3 weeks and were able to get the packages out to the well-known actors and authors and other musicians and start this incredible groundswell of support to pull this petition together, and we presented over 120,000 signatures within 10 days of when we've basically sent the packages out. And the campaign is not going to be stopped even if this amendment doesn't get through in the energy bill. The safe energy movement and the move to educate the public again about the fact that nuclear power is still no longer safe. There's still a problem of terrorist security, of every plant, every transportation, every transport of all the waste is a potential terrorist target, and it travels within 2 miles of millions. 50 million Americans live within the transport routes. If we even open up, even if the plants, the Yucca Mountain was built to store the waste that we're creating today, there's no place to store any new waste that is created by new plants. In a free market economy, this industry could not stand on its own. And so what we're doing is just re-educating and seeing democracy at work. And I'm really heartened to see how many people jumped on jumped to tell us that they really knew nothing about it, including members of Congress that we met with. They were simply not aware that this language had been inserted. So I'm really grateful that because of the way the press still works and the way that we can communicate with each other, we can mount this kind of a campaign through groups like MoveOn.org and True Majority and Common Dreams and the Daily Cause and the Huffington Post. Not just the liberal press, but the mainstream press as well covered it. And I really think when the American people think about it, they will reject nuclear power in favor of the much more viable green technologies, which are great for jobs, get us out of the Middle East, and, of course, protect the environment and address global warming.
Now, Jackson, you mentioned this earlier concerning the October 22nd petition that you people presented before Congress. What do you say to people who say that global warming is so bad, such a great threat, that we have to look for all alternatives and nuclear looks like a very good way to go? What do you tell those people?
Well, there's no question that we need to try, you know, as many alternatives as we have before us. However, nuclear power is still as deadly and as dangerous and as economically unfeasible as it was in the beginning. The problem with I'm going to skip to the present emergency, which is that the nuclear industry has inserted a certain amount of have sort of surreptitiously put in language into an energy bill, which is meant to address just that. It's meant to the bill is meant to address global warming and provide us with government subsidies and help for industries which would be absolutely clean and which would address the global warming issue. You know, and there are many ways in which we can address global warming, having to do with CAFE standards and conservation and all kinds of restrictions on industry, but it's not surprising that people in the industry want to just simply build a bunch of plants because they would actually start making money immediately on those plants. The language in the bill would allow them to just go head on into building plants. These plants always come in over budget. They're always late. I mean, you have to understand they would begin making their money, which would be more than it is ever stated that the plants would, you know, are supposed to cost, immediately, and it would be paid for by the population. And they always cite France as it works in France, but you have to understand that it's the government in France that's doing it. I mean, so you have to. It's a private industry masquerading as a solution for a problem that we're all faced with, and it's a private industry that can't pay for itself. These plants actually are economically unfeasible. So unless you have the American people standing behind them saying that we're going to pay for any cost overruns, we're going to pay for any accidents, we're going to pay for the incredible damage to the populace in general from the whole cycle of production, you know, production of this, and also the fact that they can't figure out what to do with the waste. And they said, 50 years ago, they said, oh, the solution's right around the corner. So, I mean, it's still as dangerous, it's still as unfeasible as it ever was. And what makes it emergency now is just the idea that this would just because of global warming be slipped in there. And the final thing I would say to people is that you basically with this so-called renaissance of nuclear power, you would be abrogating the responsibility. Congress would no longer have the oversight as to how much was spent. It's actually an open-ended backing of nuclear power. It's not when we say 50 million, they project they would want 25 billion this year and 25 billion next year to start building these plants. But that wouldn't be the end of it. That's just what they project. And when you think about the cost overruns and the most recent examples are, this plant in Finland and that's you know 2 years behind and 800 million over budget. You know, I mean, it's just opening a floodgate. To an industry that is, you know, very irresponsible. The problem with it is that this, as an industry, they can't get anybody to insure the plants because they're so dangerous. I just say that it's just like throwing the baby out with the bathwater to say, well, now that we have this incredible threat to the planet, that we have to invest in this very, you know, like very known to be very dangerous and untenable technology.
Would you please now give a warm welcome to the great, and I do mean great, Jackson Browne.
Some of them were angry at the way the earth was abused by the men who learned how to forge her beauty into power. And they struggled to protect her from them, only to be confused by the magnitude of her fury. In the final hour, when the sand was gone and the time arrived, in the naked dawn only a few survived, and in attempts to understand the thing so simple and so huge, believed that they were meant to live after the deluge. Let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children dry. Let creation reveal its secrets by and by. By and by. reaches the sky.
And Harvey, what do you tell the environmentalists, well-meaning, some of them rather prominent, who are wavering and, in fact, even are going for nuclear energy because of the problem of global warming? What do you tell them?
Well, first of all, I think there are very few of them, actually, and a bunch of them are on the nuclear industry's payroll. The event that we had, thanks to Bonnie Jackson Graham and Ben Harper and Keb Moe doing that great video and setting up the website, we had the entire core of the environmental movement coming out to denounce nuclear power. There's been no groundswell in the environmental movement in favor of nuclear power. We had the League of Conservation Voters, the Sierra Club, NRDC, Greenpeace, PERG, Public Citizen, a tremendous array of environmental groups. Union of Concerned Scientists sent in a separate petition. There's been no movement of any significance, really, in the environmental movement in favor of nuclear power. We've had a couple, Stuart Brand, who's actually got an organization on the industry payroll, a guy named Patrick Moore, who long, long ago was part of Greenpeace. Very, very small movement. And considering the amount of money that the nuclear industry has to spend on this, it's been quite significant, actually, how few environmental groups or individuals have come forward in support of nuclear power. And one of the main reasons is that people who know the issue, really study the issue, understand that, as Graham said, that nuclear power is no solution whatsoever to global warming. You can't build enough nuclear plants, even if there were a difference, to make a difference. There is significant CO2 emitted by the nuclear fuel cycle from mining uranium, from milling it, especially from enriching it. It does take two coal-fired plants, big ones, to just enrich the fuel for nuclear power plants. You've got transportation issues, construction issues, direct heat. Both in Alabama and in France, nuclear plants have shut because the rivers that they're supposed to cool them are too hot. The bottom line is that every dollar that's spent on nuclear power plants could be replaced by a dollar spent on increased efficiency, which, according to the Rocky Mountain Institute, would save seven times as much energy as nuclear power creates. In other words, a dollar spent on efficiency will save seven times as much energy as a dollar spent on nuclear power will create, and that's a very, very significant number. And nuclear power really worsens global warming, and the people who are in the business of saving the environment understand that. There's been a lot of hype, alleged environmental support for nuclear power, but it's really not there because nuclear power, in terms of global warming, simply can't deliver the goods.
Well, before we bring on our next guest, crusading Dr. Helen Caldicott of Australia, who has helped to spearhead so many different anti-nuclear movements, let me ask you one final question, and that is, how do you find the balance? How do you find the balance between musicality, between touching people's lives, and politics? Bonnie.
I think you do that really well, Jack, mm-hmm. not just because you're my friend, but I think you managed to find, you and Graham both have find that balance between being able to write something with conviction and anger and ferocity, and also couch it in a way that's not corny or pedantic. And that's the rub.
I agree.
No problem.
Thank you, Bonnie. And I agree that Graham has been able to do this really well, I have to say. You know, songs like, what's it, with that whale?
Wind on the Water.
Wind on the Water.
Barrel of Pain.
Yes, you know, yes. I mean, it's hard to talk about specific, scientific things in a song. By the way, Michio, have you ever thought of writing a song?
I haven't, but I work in the world of equations, but maybe one of these days I'll convert an equation into a song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, music is math.
And you've just been listening to an interview with three rock superstars, Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, and Bonnie Raitt, as well as anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman. And on October 22nd, they presented a petition to the United States Congress stating that nuclear energy is not the way to go, it's not the solution to global warming. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, host of Exploration. Well, our next special guest is Dr. Helen Caldicott. She's a crusading anti-nuclear activist, been there since the very inception of the anti-nuclear movement, and we were very fortunate to get a telephone call with her from Australia just as she was leaving for yet another protest meeting. Once again, our next special guest is Dr. Helen Caldicott, one of the prime forces in the anti-nuclear movement. Okay, now, Helen, today people are concerned about global warming, and some people, especially in the Bush administration, say that nuclear energy could be our white knight. So what are your thoughts about this revival of nuclear power?
I think it's wicked. The nuclear industry have employed Hill & Knowlton, which did the tobacco advertising, the big PR company, to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars to say, well, nuclear power is the answer to global warming. The truth is, the stark truth is, nuclear power depends upon a massive industrial infrastructure which produces large quantities of carbon dioxide, the global warming gas. At the moment, a nuclear power plant therefore produces about 30% of the CO2 as a similar-sized gas-fired plant, but as the uranium declines in concentration in the ore, within 10 or 20 years, a nuclear power plant will produce the same amount of CO2 as a gas-fired plant. So you may as well burn the fossil fuel. At least you don't get the radioactive waste and epidemics of malignancy for the rest of time.
Now, some people say that after Three Mile Island, the industry learned its lessons and the next generation nuclear power plants are safer. Therefore, we don't have to worry about the nightmare of Three Mile Island. But what about your thoughts?
Well, I haven't built a new generation nuclear power plants. It's all talking in a vacuum. The new generation they want to build are much more dangerous than the present generation, A. B, the present generation, which pump along, there are 103 of them in America, are terribly dangerous, and what they're doing is extending their lifespans from, 30 to 40 to 50 years. These reactors are old, they're dilapidated, their pipes are falling apart because of the radiation, and by extending their lifespan, they're asking for a meltdown or some meltdown. Also, they're increasing their power output, and that's shaking some reactors to bits. So the industry knows that it's very expensive to build a reactor. It's usually paid for mostly by taxpayers' dollars. But if they just keep the old ones and keep selling electricity, they make a lot of money. So they're really, they're long-term murderers, these people. It's much worse than tobacco smoking when those eight men stood before Congress with their hands on their hearts and said, tobacco doesn't cause cancer, because nuclear power and radioactive waste will cause cancer in children, in particular, in epidemics for all future generations, gross deformities and genetic defects. So, I mean, I just think they need to be called on their wickedness.
And what about the nuclear waste problem? In Yucca Mountains, Nevada, we have this eyesore that may never go online. We don't know what's going to happen with the Yucca Mountains nuclear waste repository. But what are your thoughts about nuclear waste?
Well, let's come to Australia. Halliburton, that lovely company run by Dick Cheney that's defrauding the American people in Iraq to the tune of billions of dollars, built a railway line between Adelaide and Darwin, bisecting our country. And the company that now manages it is Serco Asia Pacific, a big British nuclear waste company. We've just signed the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership with America, which designates us to not just export uranium fuel rods, but to re-import radioactive waste. And I'm sure that our Prime Minister, for whom I have absolutely no respect, and I hope he's defeated on Saturday in a national election, is very close with George Bush, and I'm sure he's done a deal whereby that they will bring America's radioactive waste, 54,000 tons, back to Australia and bury it on Aboriginal tribal land, because they've just expropriated most of the Aboriginal land in the Northern Territory. So we're in gross jeopardy, and the place they want to put it and store it is over the aquifers, which supply the water to much of central Australia.
Now let's talk about the problem of nuclear proliferation. The Iranians are buying commercial nuclear technology, which is legal. However, some people are saying that there's a defect in the Atoms for Peace program because you can take legally available commercial nuclear technology and convert it for weapons use. So what about the problem of nuclear proliferation?
Well, that's what Israel did. Israel's got the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, some say, 200 to 400 nuclear weapons. Why are they never talked about? Why is this never discussed? Why have they not signed the non-proliferation treaty? Why do they say we neither confirm nor deny we have nuclear weapons? Pakistan and India did the same, made nuclear weapons from their reactors. It will take 5 to 10 years for Iran to enrich enough uranium to make a bomb, if indeed that's what their plan is. They say that's not their plan. The IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, can find no evidence they're deviating uranium to make a weapon. And, you know, they only need... they need 10 pounds of enriched uranium to make a bomb, highly enriched uranium. But, you know, why is not the international community inspecting Israel that have 200 to 400 hydrogen bombs? I mean, the hypocrisy takes my breath away, number one. And number two, of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world, Russia and America own 97% of them. And they still have each other targeted with thousands of hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, and George Bush and Putin get 3 minutes to decide whether or not to blow up the world and destroy life on Earth. Russia and America are the real rogue states. They're the real nuclear terrorists. Why don't we attend to the elephant in the sitting room rather than looking for diversionary activity, which will mean nothing?
And that concludes our interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear activist, and we were very privileged to get this interview with her in Australia.
There's an anti-nuclear song that Jackson and I sang at the benefits, and I'd like to take a second here and invite Jackson Brown out and David Lindley to do something. So Doug Haywood, who sings with Jackson, is going to help us sing it. This one's called Teach Your Children. You sing it with us. Must be free to teach
talk about nuclear power and radiation. Radiation is dangerous to every living organism. Its effects are cumulative. Each time you get some radiation, it adds to your risk of getting a cancer. Babies are about 20 times more sensitive to the radioactive effects than are humans. On no circumstance must we increase the level of background radiation. The sun causes some cancer we see already. Yet nuclear power plants are being built around the world, and they are headless monsters. Inside each nuclear power plant is as much radiation as that released by the explosion of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs. At Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the core of the reactor was uncovered for 50 minutes, and nuclear engineers do not understand why that reactor did not melt down. By the grace of God, that reactor did not melt down, for if it had, what would have happened? Let me tell you. An area the size of Pennsylvania, to quote the Rasmussen report, would have been destroyed for thousands of years. Nobody could live there anymore. And 20% of the times the winds blow from Harrisburg towards New York and Boston. 80% of the time they blow towards Washington, D.C., where the NRC live. And that's why they were sweating a little bit before the national television cameras as it was melting. What would have happened? Immediately 3,300 people would have died. Right now, 6 to 8 weeks later, hundreds of thousands of people would be going bald. They would be getting skin ulcers, mouth ulcers, vomiting and diarrhea, and dying of acute infection or hemorrhage. Thousands of males would be rendered sterile. Hundreds of thousands of women would stop menstruating, many permanently. Thousands of babies would be born with tiny little heads, mentally retarded, and thousands more as cretins, and thousands of spontaneous abortions, and 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, hundreds of thousands of cases of cancer. It would have killed approximately less than half a million people, probably. And it would have injured another half a million more. There would have been another half a million radiation injuries. Did you ever hear any government official tell you that? Why not? Jimmy Carter's just given the go-ahead for the MX missile, which is in underground tunnels. And it will be powered by nuclear power plants with nuclear bombs inside the MX missile. That Trident submarine has enough weapons on it to kill every major city in the Northern Hemisphere, and America is building 17 Trident submarines. Over half of our federal tax goes to the military-industrial complex. By paying our federal tax dollars, folks, we're all sipping at the Pentagon Kool-Aid vat. Don't kid yourself, you can survive a nuclear war. The button could be being pressed now. There are 35 countries who have nuclear weapons capabilities because they have nuclear power plants. If we don't turn this around in 2 years, I predict you, the plants, this beautiful planet, is not going to survive. And many of us do. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has a clock set at 8 minutes to midnight, which moves forward every time a new country makes a nuclear weapon. We are a magnificent species. We're capable of such great love, such creativity, such humanity. The good side of the human being is incredible. Even the men who make the weapons, I see them die. And as they're dying, they're beautiful, frightened, spiritual human beings. We're all like that. We have to now stop this. And people say, how? You live in a democracy. You're all creative. You've got incredible potential. 18,000 people in this stadium, if you moved out, every single one of you, in the next year, you went in and interviewed the Joint Chiefs of Staff and told them you don't want your tax money being used to make nuclear weapons to kill us all by mutually assured destruction. If you marched into the Department of Energy and said, we don't want nuclear power, we want the sun. You can turn this round. To stop nuclear power, with eventual epidemics of incredible disease in young people, and to get rid of nuclear weapons, is the ultimate in preventive pediatrics. It is also a religious issue. For what is our responsibility towards God to continue evolution on Earth because we are about to destroy it? So I challenge every one of you to take on this. Nothing else matters. It doesn't matter if you're going to a party tonight, the dentist next week, what sort of food you give your kids, if you immunize your children or not, if they're not going to live their normal lifespan to the year 2000. Nothing else matters except saving our beautiful planet, and we may be the only life in the universe. Thank you.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, recorded at Survival Sunday 2 back in 1979. The event was designed to create awareness about the dangers of nuclear weapons and energy. From the Vault, the series is broadcast from the Pacifica Radio Network with 5 stations in Berkeley, Los Angeles, New York City, Washington, D.C., Houston, Texas, and over 120 affiliates nationwide. This episode was produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday.